we've really been emphasizing the body of the church. The next section in the place, you can go to Romans 12. We're finally back to Romans. Believe it or not, we're finally back to Romans. Romans 12. And I think we jumped off at verse 9. So we're going to pick up there. The next section, and the reason that we kind of stopped there, is that there's a natural break in Paul's writing there. He has been talking about the body of the church and how it interacts with each other. And over the course of the next couple verses, he's going to start transitioning to how the church ought to deal with the world at large. How should you deal with people outside the church? I've told you many times that you can read all of Paul's writing and you won't find one word about evangelizing the lost. Two-thirds of the New Testament written by Paul, he never talks about evangelizing the lost. He always talks about the church, the saved, the ecclesia, the saints, how they should deal with each other, and then how they as a body should deal with the unbelieving world. Remember that at the time Paul was writing this stuff, he was often imprisoned. Three times he was beat with 39 lashes. They stoned him and dragged him outside the city, left him for dead. He'd been at shipwreck. He'd been bitten by snakes. He'd been, like I said, imprisoned multiple times. The price he paid for what he believed and what he taught, not only was the Gentile Roman world against it because he was preaching a king superior to Caesar, but the Jewish community was against him. So that's kind of everybody. You've got the Jews, you've got the Gentiles, everybody's against what Paul's doing, except for those few people who heard Paul's message, Jew or Gentile, who were converted by it, and who suddenly said, wow, you know, this is the truth, this is life, this is the reality, so now Paul, tell us what we need to do, and that's why he was building the community of the church. The community of the church was a very, very important entity to Paul because the world outside hated the church. They either hated them politically, they hated them socially, or they hated them religiously. The people who hate sovereign grace theology the most, like it or not, is not the world at large. The world at large, for the most part, can slough us off. They don't care. That's a church over there. That's a church over there. They believe something, but I don't believe either of them, so who cares? The religious people are the people who have a problem with it. And that was the same in Paul's day. The people who Paul had the most problem with were the religious people of the day. But it was the religious people of the day who crucified Christ. So you've pretty much got an average mean line right there. Are you familiar with dominion theology? Has anybody come across dominion theology in your dealing with the church? Pretty much a Presbyterian line of thinking, though you find it in some Pentecostalism as well. Dominion theology believes that the church will one day conquer the world. You don't find that kind of language anywhere in the Bible. The Bible never talks about the triumphing church. It does talk about a triumphing Christ, and that Christ will triumph over the world. And he'll do it by coming back with a sword, and coming back with a rod of iron, and coming back and ruling over his enemies by force. That's genuine triumph. But dominion theology teaches that Christian theology will spread so far and wide that one day the whole earth will be converted to Christianity. It's usually connected to a form of postmillennialism that says that Christ won't come back until all of the earth is converted. And once the earth is appropriately converted to Christ, he will then come back and rule and reign over a converted world. Got it? You don't find that in the Bible, but it is a reasonably popular theology. There are plenty of websites out there. And like I said, you do find it a lot in some forms of Presbyterianism and Pentecostalism. The notion of the church triumphant, not only is it anti-biblical, but it comes from, there, you're all in Romans. Go back to Matthew 24. I'll show you where they get it for a second. Because Romans 12 is going to kind of undermine this kind of thinking. Go to Matthew 24. Matthew 24 is Jesus' treatise on end time events. His disciples have come and asked him, what are going to be the signs of your return in the time of the end? Let's see. His disciples came and they show him the temple. He sat on the Mount of Olives. His disciples came. This is verse 3 of chapter 24 of Matthew. And they say, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming, and what will be the sign of the end of the world? And he goes on and tells them, will there be wars or rumors of war? Take heed that no man deceive you. Many will come and say, I am Christ. Nation will rise up against nation. These are just the beginning of the birth pangs. They're going to deliver you up. You'll be afflicted. They're going to kill you. He goes on to say that the gospel of the kingdom, look at verse 14, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, if you take that verse completely out of context, you've got the notion that the gospel has to be preached, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the whole world for a witness, and until that happens, the end can't come. Paul and Jan at TBN have said that the reason they're putting satellites up in the sky is to fulfill 24:14, that once they have covered the world with TBN, that then Jesus will come back, and he won't come back before the world is covered with TBN. Now, my question is, does that verse mean that the gospel of the kingdom has to be preached by the church to the whole world before Christ can come back, before the end comes? Is it up to the church to fulfill that? Well, there are lots of people who believe that. I had a conversation just a few weeks ago with a person at work who said that, who said, well, the gospel has to be preached to the whole world before the end can come. And I said, yeah, but you know what? If you let Scripture interpret Scripture, Scripture will handle that for you. It does not say that the church has to do it. Go over to the book of Revelation. Let me show you something. Go to Revelation 14, verse 6. Revelation 14, verse 6. You're right in the middle of all the troubles. You're right in the middle of the tribulation period. You're right in the middle of the point where the seven plagues are about to come out and sin is about to be punished. This is the harvest when the angel comes down and starts cutting down all the wicked and all the evil. So just before it, since that is obviously the end, just before it, something has to happen. Chapter 14, verse 6 says, I saw, John writing, I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them to dwell on the earth, to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is coming. Worship him that has made heaven and the earth and the sea and the foundation and the waters. There is the fulfillment of what Jesus said in Matthew 24. They said, what will be the sign of the end? And he said, the sign of the end is that the everlasting gospel will be preached to the whole world as a witness, and then the end will come. John saw the end of it. The angel comes down, preaches it to every person, every kindred, every tongue as a witness against them, and then God starts pouring out the plagues and the end comes. The Bible will interpret the Bible if you'll take the whole thing in context. So the notion of the dominant church, the church triumphant, the church fulfilling Matthew 24 doesn't exist. God fulfills Matthew 24 because it is God triumphant. It is Christ triumphant. It is not the church. Get that? The egocentric notion that the church somehow has to fulfill God's plan and that God's hands are tied until those things are fulfilled once again raises up humans above what Christ is or what God is. God and Christ will fulfill their own agenda and their own timetable their own way. Now, why is that important? Go back to Romans 12 now. The reason I bring that up. During the time that Paul was writing this, and after everything Paul had been through, Rome was, in fact, almost at its zenith. Rome controlled fully a third of that entire continental land mass over there. Rome was the greatest and continued to be for years after that, after they moved out of Rome to Constantinople all the way up until roughly 1200, 1300. They were the last greatest empire on planet Earth. Rome was an enormous, long-lasting, dominant empire. Rome was much more wicked than America is, even though America's headed that way. But the people who want to say, you know, oh, it's worse now than it's ever been, look at Bill Clinton and what he did in the Oval Office. Well, let's compare that to, let's say, Caligula. Let's compare that to Nero. Those were very, very, very wicked people. At least our government has a series of checks and balances. Yes, Clinton did some rather pernicious things in the Oval Office, but he also got called to the carpet for it. But if you were the emperor, if you were the Caesar, there was no getting rid of you. There was no Senate coming up and saying, the only way to get rid of you was to kill you, which is what they would usually do then. They would just out and out get together and kill you. Now, Paul never taught in the midst of this Roman culture, a very evil Roman culture. Paul never taught that the church ought to convert the culture. You got to remember that. Paul never taught that the church was going to convert the culture. Instead, what he said was, there is the church. The church is on planet Earth, but it's not of planet Earth. Chapter 12, look back at like verse 2, where he said, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind. We looked at that weeks ago. He said, there is a world, there is a distinct world, it is an evil world. Don't let it conform you, don't be conformed to it. Don't be like it, it is not what you are. But be transformed by the rebirth, the renewing of your mind. But then he doesn't follow it with instruction to go conform the world. You can't conform the world any more than you individually can conform an unbeliever. You believe, somebody you know doesn't believe. Why do you believe and they don't? The biblical answer is because God did something for you that he didn't do for the unbeliever. He put his spirit in you. He put his spirit in you because he chose to. He chose to because he wrote your name in a book. He wrote your name in a book because he loved you with an everlasting love. He loved you with an everlasting love because he chose you before the foundation of the world. That's the biblical answer for why are you different than they are. That's why Paul said, who has made thee to differ? And if your salvation is a gift, he then said, why do you act as if it wasn't a gift? You are saved by the fact that God gifted you with salvation. Now, if you can't save, I don't know, think of somebody in your family that's unsaved. Now, if you can't convert somebody in your family that's unsaved, how are you going to convert the world, the evil, wicked world? You don't have what it would take to overpower their will. They are willfully doing exactly what they want to do, and unless you can overpower their will and change their heart, you cannot get them to stop it. Right? Why did you stop the things you stopped? Because somebody bigger than you overpowered you, and it wasn't me, and it wasn't any other preacher, and it wasn't any other man. It was the Spirit of God indwelling you and changing you internally, the one thing that no other man can do. I can't change Bruce internally. I may be able to set up criteria where I say, Bruce, if you want to be like me, or with me, or around me, you have to do this, 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 and that. And then whenever Bruce is around me, he does those things because Bruce wants to get along with me, which is the way most churches work. When you go to church for that hour or so, you act like everybody else in the room, and then nobody knows that when you go home, you're in fact very wicked and doing all the things that you pretended you didn't do when you went to church. I'm realistic enough to know, just like Paul is realistic enough to know, that what you are is sinners even when you come to church. And that when you come to church, what you are is somebody who desperately needs the grace of God in order to get through the sinful life that you're leading. And that he is changing you from the inside, but you will never arrive. Paul said, I have not yet. He was at the end of his life, ready to die. He said, I have not yet apprehended that that apprehended me. He was waiting for graduation day. He was ready to be done with that flesh where that thing that he wanted to do, he didn't do. And that thing that he didn't allow, that's exactly what he ended up doing. Until he cried out, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? He knew that left to himself, left to his body, he was a dead man. Because even though he said, I delight in the law of God after my mind, I can say it in my mind and say, yes, that's right, and it's good, and it's just, and it's holy, and I believe it, and I trust it, and everything else. And then he'd go right out and do in his flesh the things that undermine what he believes in his mind. So the war exists, and the war goes on. Now, the point of that is, so here you are, the church, the body, but now how is the church supposed to interact with the world? If you know you can't convert them, and you know you can't change them, how are you supposed to act? I think you're going to find that Paul's instruction is very sane, but it also is very different than what you see in the world today. The world today, the church, I say the world today, the church that is in the world today is still trying to change the world. Let me give you a basic. You can't legislate morality. The law of God in the Old Testament, I think, proved that one once and for all. Here's morality, I'll kill you if you don't do it. They still didn't do it, he killed them. you're not going to get people to act moral simply because you wrote it into the books. Because the problem is not external, it's internal. You can write down rules and make them governmental rules. Look, we have governmental rules that say don't kill. We have God-given rules that say don't kill. Do people kill? We have laws, governmental laws, that say don't steal. We have God's law that says, Old and New Testament, don't steal. You can't legislate it. Okay, God calls Moses. He says, Moses, come on up on the mountain. Moses goes up there for 40 days talking with God, during which time God is giving him the Ten Commandments and the entirety of the Levitical law. God's handing out the legislation. Now there's people at the bottom of the mountain who have already heard the voice. They've seen the black cloud. God spoke to them in an audible voice, and they came to Moses and said, that scared us. Tell God not to do that anymore. Why don't you go talk to him? We'll stay down here. They've seen the Red Sea part. They've seen the Egyptian children die. They came out with all the great riches and wealth of Egypt. They're now standing at the foot of Mount Sinai with the promise of the land of Canaan ahead of them. They are the fulfillment generation of 430 years of God's sovereign hand over history, bringing them to exactly the point God said they would come to. And while Moses was up on the mountain getting the legislation, what were they doing downstairs?
Worshipping a golden calf.
Worshipping a golden calf. You can't legislate morality. Moses comes down and goes to Aaron. Aaron had been on the mountain. Aaron had talked directly with God. Aaron went in and spoke for Moses. Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, let my people go. Aaron was right there for the whole thing. Moses comes down and says to Aaron, who ought to know, what's all this about? And Aaron lies and says, I don't know, we threw the gold in the fire, and behold, out comes this golden calf. Woo! People dancing naked around the golden calf. I don't know, you were up there for a long time. 40 days seemed like a long time to us. We figured we better make a god and worship it in a hurry. That's people after the flesh going their own way, doing their own thing. And that's what the world out there at large is still doing. They're still creating their idols, creating their gods, deciding for themselves who they're going to worship and what they're going to worship. They don't want to hear about a God who comes and says, let me tell you who to worship and how to worship me. Let me tell you about my sovereignty. Let me tell you about my son. And let me tell you that my son has the absolute right over you individually to decide if you live or die. Up to him. People hate that. How dare you tell me that Jesus? Don't be saying Jesus in the public marketplace. Don't be going out into the world of ideas, especially among academia, and saying the name Jesus. People say, oh, what are you, nuts, stupid, ignorant? You still need that little crutch of religion to get you through life? Please. We're grown up now. It's different now. It's no different now. They were doing it at the foot of Mount Sinai. You're doing it now, dancing around the golden calf of higher education. God said, I give my son the absolute authority to decide who lives or dies. And if God did in fact give him the authority to say who lives and dies, it doesn't matter if you agree or not. Disagree all you want. You can disagree right up until the point until he tells you you're dead.
I don't agree.
Well, guess what? You go to hell forever.
I don't agree.
I don't agree. Well, then it comes down to a question of power, doesn't it? See, the whole question of God's foreordination, election, predestination, all of that stuff, comes down to a question of power. Whoever has the superior power gets to implement their will. Right? Mike and I decide we're going to wrestle. 2 out of 3 falls. Okay, Mike's got a couple pounds on me. In wrestling, pounds equals power. So we go into a clutch, and 2 minutes later, I'm pinned. If it takes 2 minutes. Okay, 2 seconds later, I'm pinned. Mike can exert his superior will over me in wrestling. Why? Because he has the power. My lack of agreement doesn't matter. He has the power. You understand this? Is this basic enough? So, if God has already decided, already proclaimed himself, already identified himself as all-powerful, almighty, omnipotent, if he, in fact, has all power, how much power does that leave for you? That'd be none. If you are only alive because he's allowing you to live on the planet he created, if you're only here by his sovereign will, and if you are what he describes you as, a worm, if you are what he describes you as, dust and ashes, which is what we all go back to, there's the ultimate proof. People go, I have the power. I have the power. Oops, I'm dead. Oh, now I'm dust. Now I'm ashes. Where's the power? Where's your power? You have no power. When it comes time for you to die, your willpower means nothing. Nobody ever said, I've chosen not to die. I opt not to now. Doesn't work. Why? Because you have no power. You have no ability to exercise your will. God has all the power to exercise his will. So then who's going to win in that wrestling match? The one with all the power. So if the one with all the power says, I give my son all the authority in heaven and earth, which is what Jesus proclaimed, he walked around saying, all power in heaven and earth is given unto me. I will decide the living and the dead. It's up to me. I will sit on my throne and judge the righteous and the unrighteous. How much power do they have there? None. None. So the few years that you live here on planet Earth, while you're still a young man and the testosterone is flowing, you become very egocentric and say, I can do everything. I'm invincible. I'll drive fast and strap wheels to my feet and go really fast down hills. And I'll, you know, I'll do things I know are bad for me. You know, cigarettes won't hurt me. Cancer. No, I don't get cancer. I'm, well, what? Cancer, you sure? Yeah, you have cancer now. Oh, well, I didn't decide that. Yeah, because that's the way it works. That's the reality of life. You have no power. The cigarette has the power because you put it in your mind. It's infecting you. And then you're addicted to it. And then the nicotine kills you. And you go, that's not the way I planned it. Well, hey. And I'm not picking on smoking. I'm telling you that when you're young, you think you're invincible. And then you get to be like my age and you feel your body starting to fall apart. And you start going, okay, that whole invincible thing isn't working out as well now. And then you get to be 60 and you start thinking, you know, I could die any minute. You know, I could go anytime. You get to be 70 and then you start feeling like you're living on borrowed time. Then you're my grandma, she's in her 80s, and you know the time's short. I dreamed about her last night, oddly enough. In my dream I held her one last time and told her I loved her. Because the time is short for grandma simply by virtue of the fact that she's got this many years already under her belt. The clock is ticking on grandma. But you know what? The clock is ticking on Bruce. And the clock is ticking on Karen. And nobody gets out of this thing alive. Because you don't have the power. So the intellectuals who want to say, well, Jesus, you know, what is that? You don't need Jesus. That's a crutch. Religion is a crutch. They will also stand before the one who has all the power. And their intellectual ability isn't going to mean a thing. Because they don't have the power. I could be a whole lot smarter than Mike. I'm not. But if I were, and we wrestled, my intellectual abilities still don't mean anything. I can't think my way out of the weight advantage. He still has the power. God, if in fact he is God, God, if in fact sent his son, and his son is who he said he was, they have all the power. The church of human beings doesn't have the power. Because the church is filled with sinners being saved by the grace of God. The church does not triumph over the world. Christ will triumph over the world because Christ has all the power. The people who want to believe that the church is going to someday somehow magically get the power, I don't know when that happens. Apparently the people who think the church is going to triumph, at some point God is going to give them the power, but that's just ego talking. These are people who want to, just like John, one day Jesus is talking with his disciples, and they come across some naysayers, which is astounding to me, people who are speaking against Christ while he's walking on the planet. And the apostle John says, hey, Jesus, want us to call down fire from the sky on them and burn them the way Elijah did? That's what they wanted. They wanted the power. You're here, yeah, you're the Son of God, but what if we get some of the power? And what if we call down fire from the sky? And Jesus said to him, you don't know what kind of men you are. That's not for you to do. I'll handle that. You follow me. That's all coming up here again. We may not get to it today. We have to rush to get to it. This is all introduction to get you in the mindset that Paul was writing from. Paul is going to say, you're dealing with the world, is going to be based on humility, living a peaceful life, blessing your enemies. You go, how can you do that? No. I want to do that slapping my enemies. I want to do that calling fire down from the sky. I want to do that thing. That's, ooh, by the way, you know, Jesus gave John and James, the two brothers who wanted to call down or fire from the sky or whatever it took to burn them up, he nicknamed them Sons of Thunder. He gave them a nickname based on the fact that they wanted to call down fire and burn people up. You don't have that power. Christ has that power, which is why when he comes back, the sun and the moon and the stars become dark. The moon becomes as sackcloth and ash and blood. And then it says, as the lightning is from the east to the west, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the darkness of the heavens. And everybody on earth will behold him and run for fear and hide in the dens and the rocks and the caves and beg the rocks to fall on them and hide them from the wrath of the Lamb who has returned. And you know what? With all that power, he doesn't come back and go, now convert. Why? Because he never intended to convert them. And all the intellectuals who say, I don't believe in you. You don't exist. Oh, sorry. When he comes back then to mop up the planet, we're behind him, riding white horses in white robes that we got at the marriage supper of the Lamb. We're behind him, but you can read Revelation 28 times and you'll never find once where we do the fighting. We're behind him while he's fighting. He rules the earth and then sets it up for us. We come back the recipient of his power. And then what do? We serve him. We don't come back and rule and reign over him. He rules, he reigns, the power is his. You getting the feel for this? Why is that important? I'll say again, because chapter 12 of Romans is about to say the way the church is supposed to deal with the world is to do it out of humility, because judgment's coming. This is going to be Paul's conclusion. Because judgment's coming. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will recompense. And if you can realize then that the world's not getting away with it, one of the great conundrums of the church and why they want so badly to convert the world is that it appears that evil is having a heyday and the church is diminishing, which is exactly what the Bible said would happen, so that's exactly how it is happening. And then you say, but I worship God and I go to church and I study the word and I pray and I do all that, and yet the guy next door is as evil as can be, and he's got a new car and a big house and a good-looking wife, and he's got all the good stuff, and he's got no cancer, and I do, and he's got no disease, and I got problems, and he's got all the money, and I'm worshiping God, and he's living it up. And Paul's answer is, that's okay. Judgment's coming. Be patient. He thinks he's getting away with it, but he's not. And a million years into eternity, you'll see that it was all very just, and you'll understand that it's all okay. The only way that you can deal with the fact that the world is continuing to blaspheme God is to know that God is going to pay them back. And if you know that God's going to pay them back, if I'm dealing with a wicked person, I know I can't convert him. Only God can. But I also have to know that I can't punish him. Only God can. And that God will. And he's going to do it a lot more effectively than I can. Hand him a cup of water. Be nice to him. Love your enemies. Speak well of those who speak ill of you. Eulogize is the word. Eulogize. Speak well of these people who hate you. Why? Because vengeance is coming. Everybody dies. Everybody goes to the judgment. And God knows. So then if you know that, you've already won the fight. You win, because now the power is on your side. Or you're on the side of the power, either way.
When you take things upon yourself, working out yourself, you end up making a mess of things. And
just gets worse, doesn't it? Yeah. And you know what? Sometimes, especially people who want to argue theology or argue against God or argue against Jesus, there are people out there who believe it is your absolute solemn duty then to beat them over the head with a Bible and try to convert them and try to... I don't. I walk away and say a prayer. Be merciful, God. They're too ignorant to know that they are standing at the door of damnation and that they are reviling you, God, to your face. They are blaspheming the very God who would and could save them. It's not my job to convert them. It's not my job to convert anybody here. Did I convert anybody in this room? No. I have no power. But I'll drive you as hard as I can toward the one who has the power. I will push you toward the one who has the power. Then you and him work it out. If he wants you, you're not going anywhere. He wants you, you run all you want. He'll catch you. Okay, so that's all introduction. Verse 9 said, let love be without dissimulation. I told you it's the root word of hypocrisy. Don't wear a mask and pretend to be something you're not. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor, put off, with all prejudice. Put off those things that are evil and cleave to those things that are good. Let me ask you a simple question. When you run into something bad, do you know it's bad? Sure you do. Of course you do. Karen's a mom. She's deciding all the time for her son what's good and bad. She's discerning all the time. Don't touch that. It's hot. That would be bad. Oh, you love mommy. Give me a hug. That's good. And she is instilling in her child, showing him good and bad, right and wrong. Make decisions. Good, bad, right, wrong. Consequences. There's do a good thing, get a good consequence. Do a bad thing, bad consequences. We all grow up with that instilled in us. We know what's good, we know what's bad, and we naturally gravitate toward the bad. Instant gratification. Absolutely.
The good always has the better rewards, but they're long.
That's right. It takes a while to get them.
They feel mighty good when they pay off, but it's few and far between. Yeah.
But the bad gives you instant gratification.
Exactly.
Yep. And that's it. And that's the point. We, though we know what's wrong, we'll always find a way to justify it because we're smart enough to justify it. We'll justify it on the basis of everybody else is doing it or the gratification that I'll get from it or I'm only doing this once or I haven't done it in a long time or nobody will know or any number of, you know, I'm strong enough, I can take it. This won't affect my Christianity because I'm strong enough in Christ that I can handle this. Sure, Bruce can't, but I can. That's a popular one. And the notion that you're strong enough in your faith that you can do this one because, you know, this won't interfere with your faith. You're strong enough. Or the I'm free. Or it's all under the blood. I'll be forgiven later. That's just presumption. That's presuming on God. That's no different than throwing yourself off a cliff and saying, well, God will save me because it's not my time to die. It doesn't matter how you justify it. You will justify it. Paul said, do just the opposite. Instead, cling to the good and abhor with all prejudice. Put off, terminate with prejudice, the military word, the bad things. Put them off from you. Get rid of them. I have found in my own life that what I have to do is just either not be where it is or make sure that wherever I am, it's not. Whatever my particular problem of the moment is, sometimes I just must make myself get up and walk away. The longer you stay here, the worse it's going to be for you. The longer you stay here, the more the temptation's going to grow and you know you're going to give in. You know yourself well enough to know that if you hang around here long enough, it's going to get bad. So then you hang around long enough to try to find out where the break point is. I can take it a little longer. No, just get up and go. Go, 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 go. It's not good for you. Cling to the good, abhor the bad. Abhor it. If somebody came in that you didn't know, you're at a mall. Some person walks up and slaps Jake as hard as they can. Just walks up and just big guy, big hand, slap a big hand mark in the side of Jake's head. Do you like that person? No! Okay, now you're getting close to abhor. You're getting the notion now. That person is bad for you, and bad for what you love, and bad for your son. This is not a good situation, and you are going to be as angry as you can be at that person. You are going to scream at that person. You're going to go ballistic. You're going to scream at that person. You're going to be calling cops. You're going to be getting witnesses. You're going to be in that person's face, and you are going to make sure that they pay for it. Paul said, take that emotion and apply it to the bad things in your life. hate them the same way you would hate that guy. Hate it. Abhor it. Put it off. Because it can't help. It can't do any good. It interferes with your relationship with God. It interferes with your relationship with other Christians.
Clouds your mind.
Clouds your mind, absolutely. It's really, really hard to do something really evil and then go pray with a clear conscience. So abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good, and be kindly affectioned. This is verse 10 of chapter 12. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love. The translation brotherly love is the Greek word Philadelphia. Philos, Delphia, put them together, you get this Philadelphia. That's why Philadelphia is called the city of brotherly love. Be kindly affectioned. Now, I told you that the word kind, it's kind was the way it was supposed to be pronounced, which is where we get kin, kinship. If you are kin, you are family. If you're family to one another, you treat each other like family. That's the word kind. We've now diluted that word. Yeah, you don't always treat your family kind, yeah. But no, but I'll tell you this. It doesn't matter how much my brother and I don't get along, which is a bad example because my brother and I get along great. But I'm going to pick somebody without offending somebody. But let's say my brother and I don't get along. It doesn't matter how much he and I don't get along. Don't you dare get between us. Don't you come talk to me about my brother, because I'll defend him hook, line, and sinker, because after all, it's my brother. Blood is thicker than water, all that kind of thinking. Don't talk about my family. We're kin. Got that? That's the way the family of the church is supposed to be, that we are kinned one to another with a brotherly love, a brotherly affection. And how does that manifest itself? Look at that. In honor, preferring one another. Start with the assumption that they're probably better than you. Honor them before you honor yourself. It's so hard. Oh, yes. Bruce, so they're going, that's so hard. That is really hard to do. Absolutely. It's hard to prefer someone else over yourself. It's difficult to prefer anybody over yourself because we all inherently prefer ourselves. That's what it is to be brotherly love, to be kinned, and to in honor prefer one another. Now, verse 11 says, here's how then you ought to act. Not slothful in business. You know what sloth is?
Laziness.
Yeah, laziness.
We all know what that is.
Everybody in this room knows what sloth is. Okay, we've got that down. Okay, good.
I'm good at that.
We've got sloth covered. I've heard preachers stand up and say, what Paul was writing about here, not slothful in business, means, you know, show up on time for your work. And give the man who's paying you an honest day's work for your paycheck. And don't be lazy when you go to work. And don't be... That's not what the word business here means. There were no corporations doing business on an international and world scale when Paul was writing this. Nor was the word business used in that application until about 100 years ago.
This translation says, never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor.
Absolutely. Don't be lacking in zeal. Now, the word business is a contraction of busyness. Get busy. Do things. What he's talking about is the work, the zeal of the church. Remember, the context here is the church. So he said, if there is activity, things to do in the church, don't be lazy about them. That's what the word zeal is all about. Zeal is the desire to do for God, the desire to act for God, the desire to put yourself on the line and do for God. So he was saying, when you're doing things within the context of the church, don't be slothful about them. Don't be lazy about them, because after all, it's God's work. If you're in fact doing God's work for the good of God's people, do it with zeal, do it with zest, do it with joy, do it like you can't wait to do it, because this is your opportunity to serve. Don't be slothful in doing the work for God. Fervent in your spirit. That word fervent in the Greek actually has to do with burning. It has to do with a flame, that there would be a flame of light burning through you, so obvious that people would see it, that the spirit in you would not be able to be contained, that people would see something in you that was so genuine, so unique, so different, that the flame of God, the would burn through you, the Spirit of God would so permeate who you are that you couldn't hide it. Jesus used the same example when he said a city on a hill, a lighted city on a hill, can't be hid. They used to build cities on hills because it was easy to defend. especially if you could build a walled city with a big fortress around it, then you could stand at the top of the wall, and when your enemy was coming, first they had to come up the hill. Well, it's easy to shoot them down while they're coming up the hill. The problem with a city on a hill is you can't hide it. Everybody's going to go fight for it, because that's the best place to be. It's a defensible position, so you're going to fight hard to take it. Jesus said, nobody lights a candle and then hides it underneath a bushel. He said, instead, you light it, and then you put it up on a stand so that it'll light the whole room. And he said, that's the way you should be. You should be a light that lights the whole room. You should be the city on a hill that can't be hid. Too many Christians want to hide that spirit, want to quench that sense, want to keep that back, because if you are like that, you're making yourself so obvious that the world's going to hate you, because they hated him and they're going to hate you. So it's a whole lot easier to pull back. Don't let people know that's what you are. Don't let people know that you're fervent in the spirit. Don't be that light. But Paul and Jesus both said that's your place. Because for every, and this has been my experience, for every 10 or 20 who hate you for being that way, there's that one sheep who's been looking for somebody just like you. And they can't find you if you're busy hiding under the bushel. They don't know you're there. But there's always that one. So you got to ignore the 20 that hate you. Yeah, whatever, whatever. You hate me. Got it. You want some cool water? Judgment's coming. Instead, go ahead and be that for the good of the one that's going to come around. You've got to be willing to stand up and be the Christian. And then the Christians, the sheep, will gravitate toward you. To your benefit and theirs. Look, if you could play a part in the eternal well-being of somebody, if you could be the voice that God spoke through to assure somebody of their eternal destiny and introduce them, bring them to, connect them with the God of ages, isn't that worth the 25 that'll hate you for it? To me, it is. For the good of the few that are in this room. That's worth it to me. The ones that are in this room are worth the ones that hate me.
So say, what do you care? The world hates you.
I think everybody cares.
If God's for you.
If God be for us, who can be against us? You're on the winning side. Right. If you can get the, what we've been talking about, if you can get that eternal perspective. Now here, let's just plow through here. I'm going to get done. Not slothful in business. I had to deal with that. Instead, be like this. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. It's the root word for bond slave. Ministering to the Lord, recognizing that you're going to put your body on the line, which we saw at the beginning of this chapter, is your logical, reasonable service. To make your body a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, that's your logical service. And now he says, be that. Serve the Lord, whatever the cost. Serve the Lord. Be willing, have that zeal, have that fire burn through you. Serve the one who has all the power, because ultimately, you win. So big deal down here on earth for a few years, it might have bumps in the road. What's that compared to eternity in glory? There's no comparison there. Rejoicing in El Peace, the positive hope. Hope that has expectation. Hope is a cruddy word in the English, because hope has that sense of it might happen, it might not. Gee, I hope somebody gives me a car. I hope I win the lottery. Well, then you're hoping in something that probably won't happen. El Peace has that root pistis at it. It means confident expectation of something that hasn't happened yet. I know Jesus is coming back. I hope I'm alive when he does. But I know for sure he's coming, and I look confidently forward to that. That's why Paul called that the blessed hope. It's an expectation of something that's definitely going to happen. And you're looking forward to it in hope. Get the sense of that word? Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. Look, these people were being jailed. They were being burned. They were having their skin cut off. They were losing their heads. They were being torn apart by horses. They were being taken into the Colosseum and having shackles put on their hands and feet. One horse for each limb, and then the horses ran four different directions. You've never had to have that kind of... You're afraid to lose your social status. You're afraid that if people at work knew you were a Christian, you'd lose some of your social status. These people weren't afraid to be Christian at risk of having their bodies torn apart because they rejoiced in the hope. They knew there was a better thing coming, and this life meant nothing. Yeah, whatever. What? Yeah, you hate me? Great, you hated Christ too. I'm on his side. Good, this will work out fine for me. And oh yeah, judgment is coming. Continuing instant in prayer. Okay, I'll tell you what. It's 12:30. I've talked a long time, and there's so much more to cover here. Next week, when I say, where did we leave off? Just tell me verse 12, rejoicing in hope. We have to talk about continuing instant. We got to talk about distributing to the necessity. Bless them that persecute you. Bless and curse not. That means speak well of, eulogize the people who are cursing you. How in the world do I eulogize the people who speak ill of me? Let me jump down. Verse 19. We'll have more to say about this next week. Look at verse 19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourself. Rather, give place to their wrath against you. Why? Because it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. If you can get that frame of mind, therefore, verse 20, therefore, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. In so doing, you heap coals of fire on his head. Because the vengeance is coming, but it's not yours. A person who offends you because of your Christianity, look at it from God's perspective. Okay, God has saved Bruce the miserable wormy sinner. And then Bruce is offended? Yeah, God's son was so offended that they nailed him to a cross. And he died for Bruce's sin so that Bruce can be the gracious benefactor of everything Christ has created on Bruce's behalf. And then one day the world that hated Christ says something bad to Bruce, and Bruce is a little upset by that? Who are you to be offended? What are you? You're a sinner that deserves hell forever. You're a worm. You're miserable dust and ashes. Take the offense. Take it. Better to be defrauded, says Paul. Who is your supply? God. Does God's supply run short because you were defrauded? No. So instead, live the Christian means. Be kind. Be generous. Bless them. Overwhelm them. Overcome evil with good, Jesus said. So they're standing there staring at you saying, I can't believe this guy. You knock him down, he gets back up. Did you ever see Cool Hand Luke? How did Luke finally win the fight with George Kennedy?
Kept getting back up.
He won the fight because George wouldn't hit him anymore. He finally said, I don't know what to do with this guy. I can't get him to stay down. And they were all telling him, stay down! And he kept getting up again until he won because George wouldn't hit him anymore. He couldn't bring himself to fight this guy anymore. And that's the analogy. Somebody hates you? Hate you. I hate you. Can I buy you dinner? What? Here's some cool water. What do you need? You're a little short on money? Here's some money. Eventually, they've got to stop talking bad about you because you're being so good to them. They can't stand it anymore. It's really hard to say, you see that guy? That guy gave me $50 the other day, and he bought me dinner, and he came over, and he helped me move, and he's a jerk! After a while, you just win him over with kindness. Can you convert him? No. All that kindness you're doing for them is just heaping coals on their head, because vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. It's coming, but it's not your fight. It's God's fight. When they hate you, they hate the Christ that is in you. They hated him without a cause. They're going to hate you without a cause. And when it comes time to separate the sheep from the goats, and they're in the goat pack, Jesus is going to say, you offended me. And they're going to say, when did I ever offend you? And they're going to say, remember that thing you did to Bruce? I took that personally. Remember the thing you did to Karen? When you did it to her, you did it to me. Remember that time that you decided you were going to upend Scott's life because he was a Christian? Well, you did that to me. And I take it personally, and now it's payback time. You got away with it then because Scott didn't have the power to pay you back. I have the power to pay back, and my payback is huge. So if you know you've already won the fight, you don't have to fight the fight. You can just be good to that person. You understand all that? That's Paul's philosophy. Be the Christian. I've said that now for too many years. Just be the Christian, whether you're in the church circle, preferring others as better than yourself, or whether you're out in the world overcoming evil with good and being kind to those that despitefully use you. In either case, be the Christian. Represent Christ appropriately, knowing that vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, and he will recompense. And next week we're going to look at a lot of verses that say that over and over again. It is one of the forgotten messages of Christianity. Christ will triumph, and he promised you that he will triumph on your behalf. And if you know that's true, you've already won. So be nice to the losers. You've already won.